This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. It's 4 p.m. in London, 11 a.m. in Washington, Miami and New York, and 6 p.m. in Moscow. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. Coming up on today's programme, he has vowed revenge against the US for the killing of his father, but how much of a threat does the son of Osama bin Laden oppose to the security of the world, and does that threat extend beyond just mere propaganda and his father's reputation? Coalition talks in the Netherlands, which have been ongoing since the election on the 15th of March, have broken down this week, failing to form a government. We'll be asking what will happen next as the parties involved clash over matters of immigration. Staff at the UK human rights watchdog, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, are beginning a series of rolling strikes after its budget was slashed by 70%, with 25% more cuts coming in the next 4 years, amid growing fears over Britain's human rights record. The ransomware that hit the National Health Service in England and Scotland, known as WannaDecryptor or WannaCry, has infected 200,000 machines in 150 countries since Friday. Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency, has called the cyber attack the largest ransomware attack observed in history. And there's a new world record for the most retweeted tweet ever. And yes, it's just as utterly tedious as you could imagine. All of that and more over the next hour on this Tuesday edition of World in Focus. It's not unusual for sons to want to emulate their fathers, but when your dad was the most notorious terrorist in the world, allegedly responsible for the biggest atrocity ever committed, most people would stop and pause. Our reporter Mark Kirst has been looking at the emerging threat posed by the son of Osama bin Laden as US authorities warn he is about to take over leadership of Al-Qaeda.
It was the worst terrorist attack in American history. It claimed almost 3,000 lives and injured 6,000 more, and heralded the start of America's so-called war on terror. The attacks on the US on the 11th of September 2001 changed the course of history. The atrocity was claimed by the militant Sunni Islamist terrorist group Al-Qaeda, led by the Saudi national Osama bin Laden, then based in Afghanistan. What followed was the US-led invasion of that country, followed by a global rolling counterinsurgency offensive against the group's extensive networks and affiliates. But for 10 years, despite the deaths of thousands of Western troops and one of the most extensive surveillance operations in history, bin Laden continued to evade capture, taunting Western leaders with regular video messages. But then, in May 2011, a breakthrough. US Special Forces launched an operation against a compound in northern Pakistan without informing their Pakistani government ally. And within hours, President Barack Obama made an official announcement at the White House.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world that the United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, the leader of Al-Qaeda, and a terrorist who's responsible for the murder of thousands of innocent men, women, and children.
But despite the targeted assassination, Al-Qaeda continued, and now it's emerged one of bin Laden's sons has vowed revenge for his father's death. In January, the CIA placed Hamza bin Laden on their terrorist blacklist after it emerged he had written to his father prior to his death, stating that he considered himself to be, as he put it, forged in steel. Hamza had long been a poster boy for the terror group and had appeared previously on Al-Qaeda propaganda videos. But in recent years, analysts have warned his status within the network was growing, and with it the threat posed by him. In a 20-minute video entitled "We Are All Osama," the jihadist vowed revenge on the US for the killing of his father. But exactly how big a threat the group still remains is debatable since the emergence and rise of Daesh in Syria and Iraq. Well, to assess this in more detail, I spoke earlier to Dr. Ben Rich, a lecturer in Middle East politics at the International International Relations and Security Studies Department at Curtin University in Australia. Dr. Rich, given the intense focus on Daesh and its affiliate groups, Al-Qaeda appears to have dropped off the radar a bit. What potential is there for this network to become the principal terrorist threat in the world again?
Well, we see that despite the fact that ISIS is still the one claiming all the headlines here in the West, Al-Qaeda and its affiliates, particularly groups like Jabhat al-Nusra in Syria, which has rebranded itself Jabhat al-Sham, but really it's still highly likely to have this connection. Groups like Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in North Africa, in places like Mali, these groups are still very active. But as with the basic underlying philosophy of Al-Qaeda, what we've seen is that the group is sort of, in many respects, playing the long game and also allowing its affiliates to kind of pursue their own objectives. There's never been a great degree of centralized control that from the sort of the Afghanistan-Pakistan region in a way that would, say, be similar to what we see with the Islamic State, which is very much centered in Syria and very much has its control base there.
And as I understand it, as you touched on there, Al-Qaeda's never had a proper command and control structure. Rather, it's been more of a loose network of associates who have cooperated with each other on a global scale. So by going after individuals like Hamza bin Laden, doesn't that actually significantly diminish the threat posed by the network as a whole?
Well, not necessarily, because this is the thing. Because the group is so decentralized, the idea that we can sort of engage in these decapitation strikes and that the whole group will kind of collapse as a result of this is perhaps a bit fallacious in nature. I mean, we saw this with the fact, you know, that we had the killing of bin Laden in 2011. And the group has nevertheless, through its affiliates, soldiered on, has built quite a extensive presence for itself. Some would say a much more durable presence for itself than ISIS. In the Syrian conflict, we see that Jabhat al-Sham has become much more integrated with the wider opposition than ISIS, which is very isolated from those other groups. We've seen it take root in a number of groups outside of Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb in northern Africa, in places like Mali, in places like Algeria. So the group continues to function, or the network continues to function, and it still has the capacity to wage attacks on the West. When we saw the Charlie Hebdo attacks, this was an attack that was directed straight out of Yemen by the Al-Qaeda affiliates there.
And the US took a huge gamble militarily, but also diplomatically with its ally Pakistan when they launched the operation that killed Osama bin Laden in 2011. Do you think they would be more cautious if a decision was taken to target Hamza bin Laden in the same way?
Well, I mean, the question is how much actual clout and effect does someone like Hamza bin Laden have in outside of sort of rhetorical? I mean, these comments that he's recently made have, you know, they echo previous statements by that particular individual, and they haven't really seemed to elicit much action. It said they're very much rhetorical, you know, and he himself has to contend with the existing command structure of the Afghanistan-Pakistan group, where, you know, an individual like Zawahiri is still very influential, very dominant in that.
As you touched on there, Hamza has been previously billed as a poster boy for Al-Qaeda. He has been considerably exploited in propaganda videos in the past, but what actual threat does he have in terms of potentially directing, controlling and taking part in attacks himself?
He's very much, I think, sort of a figurehead and a kind of, he has the pedigree, obviously, of the bin Laden line. But he certainly doesn't have, for instance, the kind of operational commander role that his father had, that his father developed in the Afghan War. He's very much, you know, of a subsequent generation of that. So I think in terms of sort of a legitimizer for the group to sort of, you know, have this kind of almost jihadist royalty, he has some clout there, but I wouldn't, you know, put him in the same category as someone like Baghdadi, who is very much, you know, both the rhetorical sort of commander of the group, but also the director of operations, the one who's making those calls, who's making those strategic decisions.
And earlier this year, he was placed on a CIA blacklist. It's rarely mentioned, but what responsibilities should the CIA and US take in forging Al-Qaeda in the first place? They were backed, obviously, they backed the predecessor, the Mujahideen, during the Soviet-Afghan war in the 1980s. Has there been a serious debate in Washington to learn the lessons of backing such radical Islamic groups in future?
Well, I think, I mean, mean, it's nice to say in retrospect that, you know, this kind of proxy war that we engaged in, we inadvertently supported a number of rather unsavory elements. But it's difficult to kind of predict in those situations, you know, what is going to actually occur 10, 15, 20 years down the line. Obviously, there are some discussions about that that have affected to some degree the strategic thinking of these types of organizations. And this is part of the problem that organizations like the CIA have had in Syria, is actually identifying groups that they feel confident enough to back seriously with arms, with training, with logistical support. And this is one of the reasons that we're seeing now this kind of conflict emerge between the Trump administration and the Erdogan administration in Turkey, because one of the most sort of reliable allies that we can perhaps look at in terms of addressing our immediate interests in defeating IS and not fairly, you know, reliably not going to have a blowback on the continental US is supporting the Kurdish groups there. But obviously, the Turks have serious reticence about that, given their history with the Kurds in the region.
Well, Dr. Ben Rich, many thanks for speaking to us today on World in Focus.
Thank you very much.
And Mark Kirst joins me in the studio now to discuss this a little bit further. So, Mark, Bin Laden had other children, not just Hamza. Have they all followed their father's ideological extremism?
Yes, Carolyn. Osama bin Laden had between 20 and 26 children. We're not exactly sure of the precise number. And he also had at least five wives, some of whom were in the compound when he was killed by US special forces. In fact, another one of bin Laden's son, Khalid, was killed in the US assault on his secret Pakistani hideout. Many of his children following the attacks in the US, though, went into hiding in Iran, although it's thought most of them were kept under house arrest by the Iranian authorities. Now, in fact, we know Hamza was in Iran for some time, also under house arrest, although he is now believed to be currently somewhere between the Pakistani and Afghan border. But interestingly, not all of bin Laden's sons back their father's ideology or that of Hamza. One of his other sons, Omar bin Laden, is living in Egypt and is married to a British woman, and he has strongly condemned his father's actions and those of Al-Qaeda, describing them as terrible. And Omar has gone on further, and in a recent interview, he said he planned to become a peace ambassador and urged others to follow him in that, in a clip that I think we can hear now.
I plan to be peace ambassador. I just think I can help, and I put my hand to try to help the people and the civilian. And should everybody be peace ambassador, not only me or you or, and because that I do, I ask, like a lot of people, civilian asking to peace and to asking for peace, but nobody listened to them.
That was a clip of Omar bin Laden there. And Mark, what about the bin Laden's family's considerable wealth? Is there any indication that any of that wealth is being used by Hamza or other members of the family to fund Al-Qaeda's activities?
Well, we know the US have frozen all of Hamza's known assets, so it's unlikely he will be able to access that. But of course, as you know, the bin Laden family are a very wealthy Saudi family with multiple international financial interests across the world. It's interesting, for example, we've just heard a clip from Omar bin Laden, who says he wants to become a peace ambassador and denounced his father. However, both he and other members of the bin Laden family have said they want to sue the United States over the killing of Osama bin Laden by special forces, calling it illegal. I don't think that will go down very well with the thousands of victims of Al-Qaeda terrorism, and I think the prevailing view amongst most people would be that he very much reaped what he sowed. But getting back to your question, the bin Laden group is a very wealthy company and is closely linked to the Saudi royal family. In fact, they form part of the Saudi king's inner circle. You may remember Michael Moore's powerful documentary Fahrenheit 9/11 about the attacks on the US, and that resulted for the first time in US history a complete shutdown of American airspace. The only aircraft flying over the US in the 3 days following the attack were the American military planes and also private jets taking members of the bin Laden family who were staying in the US at the time of 9/11 out of the country and safely back to Saudi Arabia. That leaves you with a strong impression of how powerful, influential and rich this family is. Now, is any of that wealth continuing to benefit Al-Qaeda? Very difficult to say, but the bin Laden group is one of the biggest construction firms in the world, turning over $2 billion a year. Exactly where all that cash ends up is anyone's guess, but an organisation like Al-Qaeda relies relies on people with deep pockets to fund it. We know that Osama bin Laden used his personal wealth, built up working with the family company over many years to fund the network, in the Al-Qaeda network in the early days. Whether other family members are currently doing that is questionable given the intense focus on the family. If the authorities are serious about keeping us safe, though, you would assume it would keep a close watching eye on the money trail of the bin Laden family and where that's going.
Well, Mark, it's an interesting family tree that's had a profound impact on today's world. I'm sure we will return to that again in future. Thank you very much, Mark Kirst.
Tough questions are the most powerful weapon we have. As long as you have questions, we'll keep asking. Radio Sputnik. Telling the untold. We are above all the latest developments, and we don't take any sides. Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. On the programme, coalition talks in the Netherlands, which have been ongoing since the election on the 15th of March, have broken down this week, failing to form a government. We'll be asking what will happen next as the parties involved clash over matters of immigration. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
Radio Sputnik.
Can augmented reality technology become a threat to our privacy? Why did Google abandon its Google Glass project? Learn about the history of augmented reality from early 20th century science fiction novels to 1980s experiments with iTap devices to the virtual realms of modern Microsoft HoloLens headsets. All of that and more in our new series, Parallel Universes, How Augmented Reality is Changing People's Lives, this week on Radio Sputnik.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Hey, this is Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist,
troublemaker, and muckraker from bradblog.com.
Join me for the Bradcast. Every day, right here on Radio Sputnik, we'll have investigative interviews with newsmakers.
We'll call out the liars, frauds, and phonies, and we'll even give kudos to the good guys
when and if we find any. Stories and ideas you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Brad Friedman, for the Bradcast, every day, right here on Radio Sputnik.
By Any Means Necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us, from mass incarceration.
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video, and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
With the UK general election on June 8th within touching distance, the Tory British political and media establishment is throwing every last morsel of mud they can find at Labour's Jeremy Corbyn. Why? Simply because he poses the greatest threat to their smug free market consensus in a generation. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com. Radio Sputnik. We speak your language. Find us at SputnikNews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, coalition talks in the Netherlands, which have been ongoing since the election on the 15th of March, have broken down this week, failing to form a government. We'll be asking what will happen next as the parties involved clash over matters of immigration. Staff at the UK human rights watchdog, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, are beginning a series of rolling strikes after its budget was slashed by 70%, with 25% more cuts coming in the next 4 years, and allegations of discrimination by the Commission itself. This comes amid growing fears over Britain's own human rights record. And there's a new world record for the most retweeted tweet ever. And yes, it's just as utterly tedious as you could imagine. You are listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 21 minutes past the hour. Following the elections in the Netherlands on the 15th of March, which returned no outright majority but saw incumbent Prime Minister Mark Rutte's party, People's Party for Freedom and Democracy, or PVV, secure the biggest share of seats, several parties have for the past 2 months been taking part in talks to try to form a coalition government. This week, however, those talks broke down with no formal agreement coming together. The negotiations were taking place between Prime Minister Rutte's PVV, the Christian Democrats, the Democrats 66 or D66 party, and the Green Left. Importantly, the coalition talks did not include the far-right Freedom Party led by controversial Geert Wilders, who are the second largest party. Most parties had made pledges during their election campaigns not to form a government with Wilders, who was referred to as the Dutch Trump, and wanted to pull the Netherlands out of the European Union. But between them, the parties involved in the talks won 85 seats in the 150-member lower house in March's election, and until this week there was little warning that talks were faltering. But the talks apparently faltered over disagreements on immigration. That is according to Edith Schippers, the health minister who was appointed by the parliament to lead the talks. Schippers told reporters in The Hague, quote, "It simply didn't work on various issues related to migration, and this can't be solved with money alone. We have worked really hard, but the differences are just too big." End quote. It is not unprecedented for coalition talks in the Netherlands to take a great deal of time to form a government. Since World War II, forming a coalition government has taken an average of 72 days, and in 1977, the process took 208 days. Earlier today, I spoke with Professor Han Dorison, a senior lecturer in the Department of Government at the University of Essex, and I began by asking him what we could expect to happen in the Netherlands over the coming days following the breakdown of talks.
Well, in the Netherlands, there's actually quite a kind of fixed process that will take place now. So in first instance, the chairwoman of the second chamber of parliament will ask somebody to kind of explore the various options that are now still feasible. Most likely the same person who was leading the previous negotiations, or the failed ones, will again step into that role and inform Ms. Ariep on what's possible, what can be done. If these parties that are kind of identify agree that they want to try to form a coalition, they will start negotiating, most often with the same person that kind of explored the various options. That person will then take the lead in the negotiations. These negotiations tend to take very, very long. So the negotiation that just failed took 61 days, which nobody in the Netherlands was really surprised about that. It's not uncommon that they will last for half a year or something like that. In these negotiations, they will try to draw up a coalition government plan, which is a highly detailed exploration of kind of the main initiatives on the main issues. So what the government wants to achieve in the upcoming years. If every party then can agree to that, they will form the cabinet, distribute the ministerial posts. The government will then present itself to the second chamber And they will vote, either approve or disapprove. Normally, at that point, they will approve it, and then we have a new government.
Now, the coalition talks that have just failed, we believe that it was the matters of immigration and border controls that they came down to. Now, given that many parties made campaign pledges not to form a coalition with Geert Wilders' Freedom Party, is there any chance that they could be invited to join coalition talks instead of the Green Left?
I think this moment, it's still highly unlikely. I mean, first of all, the leader of the largest party, Liberal Party, Mark Rutte, has again this morning said that he's not interested in governing with the Freedom Party. So, you know, that's kind of like a first instance that he would be interested in doing that. But also, if you look at the possibility of you know, getting a government that has sufficient support in Parliament, even the Liberal Party plus the Christian Democrats plus the Freedom Party, they still don't have a majority in Parliament. And it becomes very hard to find other parties willing to support, you know, a coalition like that. And this assumes that the Christian Democrats and the Liberal Party would be willing to govern with the Freedom Party. So it's quite they're standing quite far outside what is the normal spectre. Also, one shouldn't forget that even though immigration apparently was a main issue, and the parties that were negotiating in the last couple of weeks couldn't agree on that, the position that has been taken by the Christian Democrat Party and the Liberal Party is still quite far from the position that's been forwarded, suggested by the Freedom Party of Geert Wilders. And this then also ties in with, you know, the general position of the Netherlands and the European Union. And so I think there's actually very little support, at least among the major parties. I'm not necessarily talking about the electorate more in large, but within the political parties to try to come up with a deal with Geert Wilders.
And if these coalition talks were to fail again, if no coalition could be agreed, what would happen then? Is there a chance that there could be another election?
Ultimately, yes, but I think that this would take quite a while. So we're talking about at least another half year before, you know, that decision would be reached, that there's really no coalition is feasible, and that some new elections would have to try to, you know, to see whether a new distribution of seats would be feasible. At the moment, there are still a number of options on the table. One suggestion that seems to be getting the most attention at the moment is, instead of asking the Greens, there's a small Christian party, the Christian Union, for the Christian Union to join the negotiations. It's possible, although quite difficult, to form a coalition with parties that are largely on the left of the political spectrum. So that's yet another possibility. And then finally, there is a possibility of a minority government. So basically, the Christian Democrats, the Liberal Party plus D66, with kind of a left-leaning Liberal Party, they would be short of the 75 seats needed, but they wouldn't be that far short of it. And so they may try to go as a minority government.
And then that they would be allowed to do that so long as a majority didn't veto them. Would that be correct?
Exactly. They would look for a minority, you know, a majority support on specific policy initiatives in the second chamber. We've had a government like that, you know, a minority government in the past. It's not an absolutely impossibility. It's generally not considered to be something desirable. You know, it's associated with less stability in the political system. But there's an interesting trade-off. If you have a very large coalition with a lot of different political perspectives in a coalition, that might be a rather unstable or you know, not well-functioning coalition government as well. So sometimes it's better to try to go with a minority government and seek, you know, support on particular policy issues.
Mm-hmm. And just finally, I know it's not entirely unprecedented for coalition talks to go on for this long. I believe there have been times in the past where it's been over 200 days. But in this case, whilst these coalition talks go on, who is actually running the Netherlands in the absence of this formal government?
It's the outgoing government that keeps going, basically. There is an agreement that, you know, they won't do any major policy initiatives, so they just keep on, you know, handling the books and you know, going on with governing and on pretty much what's on there. Of course, if something really urgent would present itself and they would have to respond, they would do so and they can do so, but at that point it would go to Parliament and ask for, you know, specific approval of that particular policy in Parliament. But at the moment, it's just the outgoing government that's still in power.
Mm. Well, Professor Dorrison, thank you so much for joining us today. It's great to get you getting us up to speed on all of that. Thank you.
Okay, no problem at all. Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Staff at the UK's human rights watchdog, the Equality and Human Rights Commission, are beginning a series of rolling strikes after its budget was slashed by 70%, with 25% more cuts coming in the next 4 years, amid growing fears over Britain's human rights record. Britain's Equality and Human Rights Commission is a statutory non-departmental public body established by the Equality Act of 2006, whose remit is to challenge discrimination, promote equality of opportunity and protect human rights. It has been awarded A status rating as a national human rights institution by the United Nations. However, the watchdog's budget has been slashed since 2010, down from £62 million, that's around $80 million US dollars, in 2010, to a projected £17.4 million, that's around $22 million US dollars, by 2020. According to the union's PCS, the Public and Commercial Services Union, and Unite, the commission sacked 8 staff by email in February this year whilst they were on a strike in a dispute over budget and job cuts. The commission's credibility has also been called into question amid allegations it unfairly targeted minority groups in compulsory redundancies. To discuss this further, I'm joined on the line now by Sputnik's Jim Ensom. Jim, what does this budget cut and strike action really say about any claims the UK may make with regards to being a world leader in human rights?
Well, I think it's rather fascinating because, I mean, the budget cut is absolutely enormous. I mean, it's come down from $80 million, their annual budget, to about $22 million. In the last 5 years, and that's an enormous budget cut. And relations between, obviously, the management in this, it's an agency, it's a devolved government agency that acts as a watchdog on human rights. And they've been doing a restructuring of it, which actually just means completely losing staff. They've failed to recruit enough new members that they want, and indeed, according to their own figures that I've seen, they've actually fallen low on recruiting black and ethnic workers, etc. These are the people who actually take cases to court over disability discrimination, human rights claims, etc. So they have been in dispute for a very, very long time. This is an ongoing dispute. What's happened now is they've started a series of rolling strikes to get publicity for their claims because they say they haven't got the money to do the jobs. And that means that Britain's claims on its human rights record are starting to be brought into question.
Mm-hmm. And we're hearing as well that several employees were allegedly sacked earlier this year by email whilst on strike in a dispute over the budget cuts. Now, this in itself seems contrary to basic workers' rights, does it not?
Well, this is what the PCS union and Unite, those are the two unions involved, this is what they've told me today. They said that, and it's their allegation, that 8 staff were sacked by email while they were on strike in the dispute over budgets and cuts. They've made much of this. I haven't heard any denial of that. But quite clearly, if that claim is true, then that's certainly, you know, coming from an organisation which is supposed to be a human rights watchdog for British workers, that seems to be a rather extraordinary action to take place because it goes against all principles of sort of workers' rights, etc.
Mm-hmm. Now, the PCS have said that their strikes in Glasgow have been very successful. They've gained a huge amount of support. However, given that the UK is currently facing scrutiny over the implementation of the Snoopers Charter and its decision to replace the Human Rights Act with a British Bill of Rights, is the government really likely to take any action to reverse these cuts?
Well, I think there will be pressure on whichever UK government, and the way things are going in the current election in Britain, it is likely to be Theresa May. Do remember that Theresa May was the architect of the Snoopers Charter, the controversial bill that was brought in. It's called the Investigatory Powers Act, but it allows for the controlled and supervised interception of data communications. In other words, collecting in bulk everyone's email, social media, telephone, all the data about that and holding it so that the police can examine it at some stage in the future. And she pressed this one through when she was Home Secretary before she became Prime Minister. So she takes a hard line on this sort of thing. But it's very interesting that you know that the watchdog, the human rights watchdog, which is at the centre of this row, was awarded an A status rating as a national human rights agency by the United Nations. But on May the 4th, the United Nations opened its own investigation into the UK's human rights record because it's looking at the government's decision to replace the Human Rights Act of 1998 with a new British Bill of Rights, and the country's decision to bring in that Snoopers Charter. And they're investigating Britain to see if it actually is in breach of its claims on human rights. The fact that Theresa May is British Prime Minister and may well be on after the election on May the 8th, it might well be that she will be, she will stoutly defend her position, and her government will, especially if she comes in with a big majority. But it is likely to give quite a lot of ammunition to human rights groups to keep the pressure on Britain. And I think that this rolling strike, which is going on for the next 21 days or so in Manchester, in London and in Cardiff, it's being rolled out right throughout the country, I think that's going to gain a lot of traction for human rights groups.
Mm-hmm. And with the people being sacked whilst on strike, it's hard not to think back to the criticisms that have been levied against the Conservative government over the past years, that they've been acting to curtail strike action and workers' rights. I believe it was former Prime Minister David Cameron that brought forward legislation making it more difficult for workers to take strike action just before the Brexit votes.
That's absolutely right. Now, most of that would normally be a domestic agenda in domestic politics, the issue of workers' rights in Britain against the government, because the narrative, of course, is that the Conservatives have always done this. They've always been the ones to take down the powers of the union and the ones to curtail workers' rights in the favour of big business. Cameron was doing it. Theresa May's government would doubtless continue to do that. But I think the interesting nuance in this particular one and this strike has highlighted Britain's international reputation in defence of human rights. Britain has always been at the vanguard of trying to defend human rights around the world, and it's been critical of other countries. But, to be quite frank with you, it deals with some foreign regimes who have very interesting human rights records, not least its military dealing with Saudi Arabia, its particular tie-up with, say, Bahrain, and there have been many other countries. So Britain has a record on, well, shall I say, two-facedness on human rights issues. But I think this particular action is likely to bring it to a head.
Well, Jim Ensom, it's a pleasure to have your expert analysis. As always, thank you very much. Jim Ensom there, and according to PCS, the Glasgow strike action today will be followed over the next 3 weeks by similar strikes in London, Cardiff and Manchester. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
Want to talk? Get in touch with us at radio@sputniknews.com.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik
with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Coming up in the programme, the ransomware that hit the NHS in England and Scotland, known as WannaDecryptor or WannaCry, has infected 200,000 machines in 150 countries since Friday. Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency, has called the cyber attack the largest ransomware attack observed in history. We'll have more on that in just a few minutes.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Technologies and human capital, global economic trends, rise of artificial intelligence, and a whole range of other international issues are at the top of the agenda of St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017. From June 1st to June 3rd, the event is hosting B20 Forum and Valdai Club, as well as business dialogues between heads of companies from Russia, United States, France, India, and Latin America. To learn more about these and other major items on the program, head to forumsbb.com.
With the UK general election on June 8th within touching distance, the Tory British political and media establishment is throwing every last morsel of mud they can find at Labour's Jeremy Corbyn. Why? Simply because he poses the greatest threat to their smug free market consensus in a generation. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
All right, I'll do one together. You ready? You ready? Max and Stacey together having oral sex. Here we go. 3, 2. Hey, Stacey.
Double down, double down.
I'm doubling down with you, baby.
Double down.
We got a new show on Sputnik.
It's markets, finance, business, economics, ka-ching, bling, and
all kinds of good stuff. Only on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Doubling down.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me back, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs programme, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to a question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
By Any Means Necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us. From mass incarceration...
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
This is Radio Sputnik.
Broadcasting from Edinburgh, Scotland, you're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik.
With Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott. Welcome back. Still to come on today's programme, the ransomware that hit the NHS in England and Scotland, known as WannaDecryptor or WannaCry, has infected 200,000 machines in 150 countries since Friday. Europol, the EU's law enforcement agency, has called the cyber attack the largest ransomware attack observed in history. And there's a new world record for the most retweeted tweet ever, and yes, it is just as utterly tedious as you could imagine. You're listening to World in Focus on Radio Sputnik. It's 43 minutes past the hour. Last week, the ransomware, which locks users' files and demands a $300 or £230 payment to allow access, spread to organisations including FedEx, Renault and the Russian Interior Ministry. In England, 47 NHS trusts reported problems at hospitals and 13 NHS organisations in Scotland were affected. But what has been done by governments and organisations to curb such attacks? Over to Sputnik's Alexander South for more information.
Following an international cyber attack last week affecting the organisations of 150 countries worldwide, disruption continues to spread. The attack received international attention when the UK's NHS was effectively placed on lockdown, with computer systems being held ransom and further machines powered down to prevent the spread of malware. Critical patient information was rendered inaccessible, with several hospitals urging people to avoid accident and emergency departments, except in cases of real emergencies. As well as the NHS, Spanish telecommunications firm Telefonica, German railway provider Deutsche Bahn and Russia's interior ministry, among other organisations that have been hit hard. But what are governments and organisations doing to protect and halt large-scale cyber attacks? Joining me now to discuss this story is Professor Helgi Janek, Head Director of the Cyber Technology Institute at De Montfort University, Leicester. Hello, Professor Janek.
Hello.
Before we discuss what measures are being put in place to protect government and private organisations from wide-scale attacks such as these, how severe has this attack been?
Well, this was a very, very large-scale attack, as you can see from the consequences. I mean, the NHS being in lockdown and patients not being able to go to appointments. And obviously some operations, critical operations, have been cancelled as well. That is obviously a major impact that you can see. And in your introduction, you clearly outlined that that wasn't just the NHS. This was a global attack in a way. So with a large number of countries being affected, telephone services in Spain, and I think you mentioned Russia as well at this point. So this is quite a large scale of the effect that has taken place.
And have we ever seen an attack of this scale and size before?
I mean, there we have viruses going around, but I think what makes this one so particularly difficult is that it's a ransomware attack, which renders systems unusable. So, which means the system, the data on the systems that are affected is being encrypted, and that means users and personnel can't access the data anymore, and that obviously is a big problem if you rely heavily on your IT infrastructure, such as NHS does. The other part is this is not a traditional ransomware in the way that it's just affected the single computer on which it was downloaded. It also had characteristics of a worm, so it was replicating through the network and spreading to other vulnerable machines inside of the network.
And what has been the initial response from organizations and departments hit by these attacks?
I mean, what you've seen is that there was an immediate lockdown of some services, so that essentially any further spread did not have, shall I say, fatal consequences in the way that some of the back-end systems are operating. Also partly geared towards stopping the spread of the worm in there. And then to a large extent, the efforts are in the recovery of it, because we are not minded of paying ransom for ransomware attacks. That obviously would not be such a great idea. But we're looking at restoring these systems from backups wherever possible.
Are organizations and governments investing enough into cybersecurity? And is this a wake-up call for many organizations worldwide?
I think it is a wake-up call. And one of the problems is that security is very difficult to quantify. So you can never be 100% secure, even if you throw a lot of money at it. So it is about making a risk assessment of how high the risk of attack is and how much money you want to spend on defenses at that point. So I think it's a judgment call at that point where you spend the money. However, there should be a minimum standard in terms of cybersecurity that organizations adhere to. And I think some of the organizations that have been affected obviously fell a bit behind the standard. And they can then see that some organizations with a better security posture manage this kind of attack scenario significantly better than others.
Today, cybersecurity researchers have found potential evidence that could link these attacks to North Korea. Is it too soon to draw these connections of who's likely to blame?
Yeah, attribution is a very complicated problem in terms of cyber attacks. There's so much scope for putting ruses in there and kind of disguising your identity in cyberspace, that attribution is a very difficult thing to do with any level of accuracy. For many scenarios, accuracy is not not really required to that extent. So especially when you enter the field of politics, it just becomes what is the most likely opinion. But it's very difficult in this area to be really sure who the attacker was and find really watertight evidence of that.
Finally now, despite organisations controlling the stem of cyber attacks over weekend and early this week, we're still seeing these attacks spread to countries like China and South Korea. Is this the calm before the storm, so to speak, or is the worst yet still to come?
It would be nice if I had a magic glass where I could just look inside and see what is to come. I don't think I would like to make predictions about the future at that point. But the key thing is that this demonstrates that these large-scale and reasonably coordinated attacks are possible. And I think that a lot of countries are placing extra resources in preventing cyber attacks of this scale to take at least the effect that this particular attack has done, and also make sure that the general population is much more aware of what the risks are in cyberspace. Organizations are aware of the risk and put the right mechanisms in place to effectively deal with this kind of cyber attacks should they take place. And the UK's National Cyber Security Center and the initiatives that are running out of that is a very good example.
Professor Helgi Janek, Head Director of the Cyber Technology Center at De Montfort University, Leicester, thank you for talking today on World in Focus.
Thank you.
Alexander South, Sputnik News, signing off.
And finally, when it comes to social media, there seems to be an easy formula for clickbait. But when it comes to the most retweeted tweet ever, you'd think it'd be something massively important, wouldn't you? Something of global importance. Well, of course not. Ellen DeGeneres previously held the record for her selfie taken at the Oscars in 2014, but her record was shattered by a young American Twitter user called Carter Wilkerson. And it all began with Carter's need for chicken nuggets. Carter jokingly tweeted a well-known American fast food restaurant asking how many retweets he needed to get a year's worth of nuggets. He was met with what seemed like a crazy response of 18 million. But he didn't need 18 million to secure the world record, and in just over a month, Carter managed to secure over 3.43 million retweets, and it's still counting. Perhaps not enough to secure him his nuggets, but it did get him a $100,000 donation to the Dave Thomas Foundation, and we believe that the fast food outlet has been impressed enough to give Carter some nuggets anyway. And that's all that we have time for on this edition of World in Focus. Don't forget you can listen again to this and previous shows at sputniknews.com/radio. This is Radio Sputnik in Edinburgh. In just a moment, we'll be handing over to Washington, D.C. for the Tom Hartman Show. And until tomorrow, from me, Carolyn Scott, goodbye.
We are talking
24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
You are listening.
We give you the most essential out of the endless information space.
Radio Sputnik, telling the untold.
From June 1st to June 3rd, state officials and decision makers from top Russian and global companies are gathering in St. Petersburg for a one-of-a-kind event. St. Petersburg International Economic Forum 2017 is set to welcome over 12,000 participants from 133 countries and feature discussions on most pressing issues of today, all under the aegis of its core theme, achieving a new balance on the global stage. Top government figures and leading experts from all around the world are meeting at the biggest platform for international discussion. For more details, head to www.forumspb.com.
Mainstream news coverage catches the big moments.
60 people confirmed dead.
Brexit means Brexit.
We will make America great again.
But what about the stories behind the stories?
The untold stories hidden beneath the mainstream.
Several hundred guys on voluntary starvation.
Intelligence agencies cannot admit they make a mistake.
If they tell me, I will be killed myself.
Sputnik's daily global current affairs program, World in Focus, with Jack Foster and Carolyn Scott.
Join us live from Sputnik Studios in Edinburgh, Scotland, every weekday from 4 p.m. in the UK, 11 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and 7 o'clock in Moscow.
By any means necessary is your guide to the movement and efforts shaping the world around us, from mass incarceration.
No longer am I interested in or concerned with prison reform. I am interested only in the eradication of prisons.
To the battle between police and water protectors.
It was a pretty punishing disregard for the sanctity of human life that unleashing water cannons on peaceful, prayerful water protectors.
From efforts to protect the environment.
The climate movement is ready to, with plenty of opposition research and force and strength, along with, you know, the right of both science and morality to fight them on this.
To the movement for Black Lives.
When I first saw the Michael Brown video and I saw that it clearly contradicted the narrative put forth by the Ferguson Police Department and by police supporters in general, three words came to mind. Color me shocked.
Stay tuned to By Any Means Necessary, 5 days a week here on Radio Sputnik.
Hi, this is Max Kaiser for Double Down. New show on Sputnik with Max Kaiser and Stacey Herbert. Everybody's doubling down. Central bankers are doubling down. Gambleaholics are doubling down. Everyone's doubling down. Why don't you double down? Right here at Sputnik with a new show called Double Down with Max and Stacey. Bye, y'all.
With the UK general election on June 8th within touching distance, the Tory British political and media establishment is throwing every last morsel of mud they can find at Labour's Jeremy Corbyn. Why? Simply because he poses the greatest threat to their smug free market consensus in a generation. Join me, John White, for the next episode of Hard Facts.
Tom Hartman.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Oddly enough, it's not nonfiction books that seem to animate the right. It's novels, because this vision of America that comes out of the right is something that you have to make up. You know, it's not like you could write a book saying, oh, here's a right-wing country that works really well. Let's emulate them.
This is the Tom Hartman Program
on Radio Sputnik.
Tune in to Loud and Clear with Brian Becker for the latest news, commentary, and political analysis. What's really behind the political and social crisis gripping the United States and the world? Forget the spoon-fed soundbites from the pundits who know so little about so much. We bring you independent experts, analysts, and activists. Learn what really makes the decision-makers take from the boardrooms of Wall Street to the West Wing of the White House. Here is where the people fighting for change speak and are heard loud and clear. 5 days a week on Radio Sputnik and SputnikNews.com.
Capitalism is going through a spasm caused by its own generation of technologies that undermine itself.
How can you, with a straight face, make the argument that more guns will make us safer?
We need to build a wall, and it has to be built quickly.
Ray Bradbury, the author of Fahrenheit 451, once wrote, "If you don't want a man unhappy politically, don't give him two sides to question to worry him. Give him one. Better yet, give him none. Let him forget there's such a thing as war." Level Talk program has been devised to offer two sides to any argument. We don't want to make up your mind for you, but we do want to be sure that you know both sides of any story. Tune in to Level Talk.
Every day we ask questions.
Were you not surprised that somebody executed Sheikh Nimr al-Nimrod?
Well, do you see this as being a human rights violation?
Are the cows really stinking up the planet that much?
To move ideas forward.
A gravitational wave is a ripple in the fabric of space and time.
I don't think the launch of the satellite proves anything at all.
Where do good ideas come from? We connect with independent thinkers, hear their ideas, and create stimulating debates on real issues.
The Dow is in a correction. As I said, commodities across the globe are collapsing. Why is that the case? Because we are in a global recession.
That is set to change because Iran has approximately about 50 million barrels, which it had put in storage during the height of the sanctions regime, and that's ready to be released as soon as possible.
Where is the money?
The super rich individuals and the world's biggest companies are able to hide money in tax havens.
Is there a solution to the crisis?
No, because I don't think anything useful has come out of any of the policy reform discussions with respect to financial reform.
They give us answers we aren't always prepared for.
This recession will be even worse than it was in 2008.
But that would be the nasty way for it to happen, you know.
But because of Guantanamo, the U.S. is no longer taking so many prisoners. So instead of taking prisoners, they kill people.
They aren't always prepared to answer.
What are the exact technicalities of this offer by the European Union to Turkey, Jim?
I just love the way you ask that question. What are the technicalities of an EU offer? The answer is, of course, a classic EU fudge.
Well, I'm a diplomat, Jim. You know that.
Absolutely.
Welcome to the show.
Hello, Abigdor. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm smiling.
How are you?
Thank you very much. Pleasure talking to you.
Always a pleasure talking to you as well.
Hello, Abigdor. How are you?
I'm fine. Hello. Although the views which I express are not necessarily the views of the editors, but one thing you'll agree with me.
You know, with that said, we've had our fun, I guess. Is it time to get serious?
So you think we really should take this warning 100% seriously?
Welcome to the party.